question of, suppose you would call this tactics, but a question of working through the parliamentary democratic institutions, right, and the alternative of being a more revolutionary type of party. Yeah. Did that come up as a issue in...
It has come up in various ways in our party, and it has been dissolved.
In what
in the sense that there is no fundamental contradiction between utilizing whatever democratic rights, including parliamentary institutions, there are to the full, and the realization that the emancipation of the people can only come as a result of the revolution of the initiative of the people themselves, that is to say, through the revolution. We see no contradiction.
So, you take the parliamentary institutions as a step, use that as a step towards...
towards revolution, yes. Mm. But by revolution, we don't mean what the Deluge means.
Yeah.
We means people, the common people, participating actively in politics and moulding their own destiny. That's what we mean by revolution, and we see no contradiction between that revolution and elections or a parliament, or no elections and or no parliament.
Mm-hmm. I see, and you can use the parliament to undertake radical reform of a revolutionary nature.
Yes.
But sometimes when reading speeches and made by some members of the party, there seems a slight ambivalence, you see, while they many emphasize the parliamentary process, which is, shall I say, a peaceful way of, which could be a peaceful way of change in society, of undertaking radical reform. Others speak in such a manner which as to indicate that they haven't ruled out the possibility of extra parliamentary methods.
Well, you see, even if you come to power through parliament, it is absurd to imagine that you can introduce socialism without the revolutionary coming forward of the people. It's illusory to think that you can pass some laws and through a bureaucracy change the social system. You can't. But of course, if you were in power and you had the state power in your hands, it would be much easier to get the people, help the people to bring about the social transformation.
Mm-hmm.
That's all there is to it. In any case, it would be the people that would be doing it, and not the governmental machinery.
So, on this basis, you are implying that you cannot undertake revolutionary reform without the support of the majority of the people.
No, it is the people who will change society.
But wasn't, at least looking at the history of the Soviet Union, the Bolshevik group was in a minority at the start, and they seized power, and it is...
You see, I'm not saying that there are no ways of changing society.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not saying that a human being cannot be born through a cesarean operation.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, people are born through cesarean operations, and some are born 7 months after conception. But what I say is that there's a normal process of birth after 9 months. And even in society, we are aiming at what is normal. Of course, all kinds of abnormalities are possible. You can change the social system with the military dictatorship. Such things have happened. But we are hoping to do it through the normal revolutionary channels.
Mm-hmm. And turning to the elections of 36 and 47 and even 52, how far did the caste factor help you, in the sense that many of the older elements, and then in 47 the UNP, were largely Goigam?
Mm-hmm.
In particular constituencies, didn't you get the low caste vote?
This is there, not a question of Goigam, but there is a question that our movement, Samajwadi Party and Samajwadi movement from the start, has found it naturally easier to gain support among the most exploited and the oppressed elements of society. It has had a bigger appeal for them than for those elements of society which enjoy some kind of privileges. And for that reason, more than among the Goigam, from 1930 5 onwards, our party has gained a hearing from the so-called depressed classes.
Mm-hmm.
More than some are going on, because they have people who are more oppressed.
Mm-hmm.
In addition to the economic oppression, which I suppose going to a mass oppression subject, in addition to that, there was a caste oppression also.
In fact, taken alone, is the Goigama caste the majority, and the other castes together, other so-called lower castes, greater in number than the Goigama?
No, I don't think that the, certainly the so-called depressed castes are. It may be that all the other castes put together, depressed and non-depressed,
mm-hmm.
might equal the Goigama perhaps,
mm-hmm.
or come close to equaling them.
But regarding the support won by the LSSP candidates, or should I say the Marxist candidates in various constituencies in the early years, in many cases it would seem to have been due more to the family base rather than Marxism.
So that I think could apply only to two constituencies. One is Avisalaya,
Philips,
and the other is Bakura.
Mm-hmm. What about Mr. Subhasingh later on?
We are talking of the early years.
47, 52?
No, 47. Quite possibly. The fact that his family was known in that area, yes. Yeah, okay.
If I may ask, your case too, in the Pandura area, that area?
Well, I did not be in Pandura till 1956.
Mm-hmm.
In any case, my family has no influence in the Panadura area.
Mm-hmm.
We are not an influential family. Far from it.
And could you tell me something about the Yamuna talks in 47?
No.
I mean, wasn't there an effort to form a government by a coalition government because UMP didn't have a straight majority?
There was, but I'm not well informed on those matters because I was working in India most of the time,
mm-hmm.
and came to Ceylon merely to work for the elections.
Mm-hmm. Looking back, I wonder whether the Sama Samaj has made a mistake at about that time in not trying to coalesce with Jorge de Silva, and B, take up the offer presented in 47 of a coalition government.
With Ponna also.
Oh, was it with Ponna too? But with, I think, the Sri Nisanka.
But I remember Ponna also.
Why?
I don't know, so I'm not in a position to answer.
Mm-hmm. And what led to the reunion in 1950? Philip's group apart.
Mm-hmm.
What brought the other elements together again?
The other Trotskyists,
yes.
together. Well, I think the tragic experience of the futility of clashing.
Did the Gampaha by-election...
Gampaha by-election at that effect.
It sobered...
Highlighted the fact that this lack of unity was helping nobody.
Have you any idea how Philip's union with the Communist Party, 50 to 55, worked out?
Well, it did not work out, it broke up.
Mm-hmm. It is said that the Communist Party grabbed or won some of his supporters.
Mm-hmm.
How far is that correct?
I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
It may have been so, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it didn't work out. It broke down.
And how effective or ineffective was the Hartal?
The Hartal was effective in the coastal areas. I would say in the traditionally some smartest areas. It was a big success. People were behind it.
But did it help to strengthen the support of the LSSP, bring in new members?
Perhaps not. Perhaps not.
Mm-hmm.
But certainly contributed to the downfall of the United Nations Assembly.
In 56. Going back in time, somewhere in 51, late November, attempts were made to forge an alliance with the SLFP. What happened to those?
When?
51, before the 52 elections.
No, there was an effort to have a no contest agreement with the SLFP, which was only very partially successful. We clashed in about as many places as we did not clash.
Why? On what grounds, I mean, for what reasons was it partially successful?
I suppose both parties were wanting to fight those seats. We each of them thought they had a better chance than the other.
Mm-hmm. Did the SSP doubt, have strong doubts about the extent of support Banda was likely to get?
In 1952, really neither party was able to gain much support.
Mm-hmm.
So I suppose one could not say that the LSSP underestimated the strength of potential support of Banda. Oh, let us go for 56.
Oh, I see, yes. Would you say that you did worse in 52 than in 47?
Yes. Comparatively speaking.
Mm-hmm.
Not absolutely. Absolutely, you got more votes.
And what led Dahanayake to leave the party?
He was expelled.
Oh.
For breaking the decision of the Central Committee not to welcome the UNP Prime Minister when he arrived in Goa.
Yes, he met him at Gentora Bridge and...
Garland. He was expelled for breaking party discipline and disobeying party orders. Not for Garland and the Prime Minister.
And what led to the 53 split?
53, a section of our party broke away in the direction of the Communist Party. Some of them went the whole hog, others stopped their pilgrim order.
On what issue really did?
Well, two issues. One is that they wanted to accept the leadership of the Soviet Union. The other is that they were for a popular front.
Mm-hmm. And how many dissidents were there?
I think about one-third the participants certainly voted against the position of the leadership. And a little less than one-third broke away.
How many Central Committee members?
I can't remember.
Roughly the same proportion, perhaps?
Roughly the same proportion.
Did any of them rejoin the party or...?
I think some did, but not many.
And what do you think hindered the formation of a united front in the early 50s?
The early 50 means before 1952.
No, before 56. There was 55 United Front which collapsed, didn't it?
Well, in 1956, there was this kind of United Front with the SLFP in the elections. There was a no contest agreement.
Mm-hmm.
Nothing more than that.
No, I was thinking of before that. Why was there no United Front with the other Marxist element, Philip and the CP?
Well, there was a United Front between Philip and the CP, which broke down. Then after that, Philip had a United Front with us, which broke down on the question of the distribution of seats.
Mm.
Then came the 56 elections, where Philip formed a coalition with Mr. Vallabhbhai.
When the LSSP had a meeting in 55 and advocated parity, it was broken up by some thugs. Have you any idea who was behind it?
I don't know who was behind it, but they were UNP-oriented people who broke up the meeting.
Yeah, it is notable that in 55, at the Alatnora by-election, UNP won, and LSS became second, and the SLF became third.
Mm-hmm.
So the swing to the SLFP really came between 55 and 56.
Yeah.
What do you think led to this?
I think there was a single nationalist revival, which was headed by the SLFP.
Mm-hmm. Was the vote in 56 more anti-UNP than pro-SLFP?
I think it is also positively pro-SLFP. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose the coastal areas, it may have been merely anti-UNP and less pro-SLFP. But as you got more to the hinterland, it was more positively pro-SLFP.
Mm-hmm. Now it is noticeable that in post-56, you had a policy of responsive cooperation with the SLFP. But yet, you led some serious strikes in 57 and 58, strikes which affected government. What brought this on?
There are two types of strikes. One type of strike was the strikes of economic strikes to the workers that you would support in any case. It's not a matter of surprising. And the other one, of course, is we had a one-day political strike against an amendment to the Public Security Act.
Oh yes.
There's only one political strike, and that was against the Public Security Act. The others were economic strikes.
Is what led Bandar to pass that act?
I don't know, I couldn't say. Mm-hmm. Because we didn't see any necessity for it.
And it's not so that the CP didn't join in that.
No.
Have you any idea why? Was there?
I think that they were more sympathetic to Mr. Vandanayake's government than we were and did not want to embarrass them.
And what about the strikes in 61, 62, just before the coup? Because I recall that a good friend of mine who in the Vasti, who was a member of the party, your party, said that they wanted to bring the government down. I was wondering how far that was correct.
But certainly we were not wanting to bring the government down by strikes.
But weren't
those strikes were economic strikes, they were not political strikes.
Mm-hmm. Isn't a general strike, in a sense, a political strike?
It has the potentialities of our politics. It's mm-hmm. capable of developing into a political struggle. It doesn't necessarily follow the aim of the general strike itself is political.
Mm-hmm.
General strike can take place on economic issues. Because you can't continue without posing the question of power. That's a different question. In any case, there was no general strike in 61
mm-hmm.
or 62. The wave of economic strikes.
Yes, but didn't you intend to have a general strike?
One day, mm-hmm. which is a
token.
Yes, token strike, compelling the government to settle the other strikes.
Mm-hmm. Just going back to 56, I forgot to ask something. How important was this support of the monks to the bhikkhus to the SLFP?
I say that the support of the bhikkhus, the SLFP, was itself a symptom of a change, that is, a growth of Sinhalese and Buddhist national consciousness. But it was a symptom.
And would you say it was the rising of the non-privileged classes in the rural sector?
The economic side of it is that.
Mm-hmm.
Or the economic root of it is that. I won't say that the only root is economic, but the economic root is important. Certainly the economic root is that. Jobs and position.
And the political route?
The political route is just, after all, is Buddhism, the religion that had suffered quite a bit of discrimination in the past,
mm-hmm.
and people began to feel that it had been its rightful place as the religion of the majority. That's one aspect of it. I suppose there were other aspects too.
In fact, a general question arises out of that. From your point of view, hasn't the conservatism of the peasantry and their religiosity, Buddhist-wise, been a big obstacle to the winning of their allegiance?
No, I don't think so. On the contrary, I think the fact that Buddhism itself is a very rational religion, and above all, that it is an unorthodox religion. Unlike the Catholic Church, for example, has prevented religion from being a hindrance to social progress. That is the Buddhist view. But what has been a hindrance to progress are the vested interests among the in the organized section of the Buddhist religion, that is among the Nayaka priests, who almost to a man, I would say, are on the side of the capitalists.
Yes, in 56, for instance, there is much ado made about the supposed SLFP God. But didn't the UNP too have a significant section of the priesthood supporting them?
The UNP then as now had the Nayaka priests, the vested interests. Of course, I think they were more silenced at the time. In the face of the coming to consciousness of the people and of the lower ranks of the Buddhist monks, I suppose they were more silent than today.
But apropos of your coalition with the SLFP now, hasn't it led to a significant modification of the Marxist line in that both individually and generally you have had to give up the traditional idea which is expressed in that cliché, religion is the opium of the masses?
That is a cliché that we have not not used. It's just a cliché that has been used by the capitalist press against us, not now, but from 1935. So the so-called opposition to religion is a bogey that has been created from 1935 by our opponents, not only us.
So then from that day, 35, I mean, from your inception, you never followed this line?
No.
But this is...
We never followed a line, an anti-religious line.
But looking at international Marxism, hasn't that been anti-religion?
I don't know what you mean by international Marxism.
Shall I say...
Yes. As Rosa Luxemburg? No. She has not followed any anti-religious line.
As, say, in Marx itself? Or Trotsky to that?
No, Trotsky, that means Russian.
Yeah.
Yes. The Russian, Russia, the social democratic movement, and that includes the Mensheviks, took an anti-religious line. Because in Russia, Tsarist Russia, the church was closely combined together with the state, both as an economic and political oppressor of the people. The same in Spain, where the Catholic Church is the biggest landowner. So there also you find the movement, socialist, communist, anarchist, taking an anti-religious attitude. But that does not necessarily take place in countries where the organized religion organized or unorganized, does not play the role of exploiting and oppressing.
But isn't the Buddhist, for want of another word, organization, also capitalist in that they own a fair number amount of land?
Very little, yeah. Compared to the Catholic Church, the Buddhist church is a pauper.
Just a few odd questions. How many members do you have now? If that's not a secret, I mean.
Well, we don't disclose the number of members. And that I don't think is essential to a social theory. Perhaps it may be useful thing to a purely political survey, which is not your purpose.
And could you tell me something about the Delimitation Commission of 59? Wasn't that very important politically?
59?
Around that time.
But in what sense do you mean politically?
I mean, didn't... was it packed and did the formation of constituencies tend to help the government?
I really don't know whether you can bring about all the difference by the way you carve out constituencies. Although, of course, there's this much to it, the weightage for the Canadian provinces was increased.
Still some more? It is already
increased on account of area. Now it was increased because of the disfranchised Indian voters.
Yeah,
that was something. But as far as the rest of the country is concerned, I don't think it would alter much.
And it's noticeable that they got rid of multi-member constituencies, but kept Colombo Central as one.
Well, there are other members, multi-member constituencies. However, there are still other multi-member constituencies. In particular, in Eastern Province, there is multi-member constituencies.
And, now for instance, it's notable that they put the Padua caste into the Dedigama electorate.
Badgama caste.
Badgama.
Yeah.
Caste into the Dedigama electorate. And I wonder whether that was an effort to embarrass the UNP.
I don't know. I can't tell you.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think all these machinations really make any significant difference in the long run.
Mm-hmm. What about registration? Isn't that crucial?
Yes.
And, you know, there have been allegations that particularly the government in power uses its power engineering the registration to their advantage.
I don't think the government in power does that. But it may well be the underlings do it. May well be.
It is possible.
Yes. It may well be the underlings do it. I know that certainly in my area, quite often, the people registering, the headman used to register, did not register many people who were voting for me. But again, as I say, these can affect the fringe only. Can't affect anything very much.
This has a bearing on the party organization at the local level. If the organization was good, presumably they could prevent this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. Well, there is some effort being made now to prevent that kind of thing, in cooperation with the Department for Parliament Elections.
Have they been cooperative on this
side? I don't, yeah, they have said they'd be cooperative. We are trying to cooperate with them. How far it will succeed, I do not know. It's the first time it's being tried this year.
In fact, how does the party assess each constituency? You all don't have statistical units as such. It seems to be a very rough and ready organization.
Assess in what sense? Working class,
yes.
Class composition?
Class,
we have no means of working out that.
Mm-hmm. Finally, sort of a different tack. About this, I'm interested in your views on the civil service. In the 30s and 40s, what would you say were its shortcomings, its assets?
Not a question merely of the civil service, it's a question of the whole administrative machine.
Mm-hmm.
Even today, it continues to be predominantly one that is not suited for the purposes it is called upon to fulfill. It's very suitable for the old colonial days when the main purpose of the administration was to collect taxes and to keep the people down. But the whole administrative machine, not merely the civil service, has to be reorganized.
In what direction? In what
in the direction of making it bringing it closer to the people, making it more responsive to the needs of the people, and more geared to development.
How can this be done?
It has to be reorganized.
You feel that civil servants, and particularly GAs, have generally been disdainful towards the public?
I feel that the whole civil service is useless. People who recruit with that were recruited for some different purpose. Nothing to do with what they are called upon to do today.
Conservative.
Conservative to maintain the status quo and to prevent the spending of government money. It's not suitable. They've got to go.
She's sparing in attitude?
Well, it's more than that, you know, the purpose is not to spend money, the purpose of government is not to spend money. So they try to stop the spending of money wherever it's possible.
Negative attitude.
Well, the purpose of government, according to the tradition they have brought up in, I presume, is one of collecting taxes for the people and keeping them down.
But wasn't there a certain element of impartiality which is fast disappearing today because of the political process and the involved?
But there are other factors. I mean, there are very good things about the civil servants. They didn't take bribes, which is even a better quality than the quality of impartiality.
Mm-hmm.
But that's of no use. I mean, that's not enough. Just not enough.
Didn't it change after 56?
Attitudes have changed, but the machinery has not changed.
But isn't the attitude the crucial thing?
No. The attitude is useless. You've got a treasury sitting on top of you. It prevents you from doing anything.
You think there are too many clerks and forms also?
No, I think the whole organization has to be reorganized because this present governmental machinery, administration, has not been built for the purposes of today.
Mm-hmm. What about the unified administrative system?
Administrative service.
It has been an improvement, has
yes,
it?
Definitely.
And what about this cooperation system? Hasn't it given us, that it is supposed to give greater flexibility?
What do you mean cooperation system?
Formation of corporations.
This is a step forward. I mean, you can't run businesses as government departments, but that's only one step forward. There are several more steps that have to be taken.
Any in particular you would...
Well, what our coalition program suggested, that we've got gradually to hand over the power to the people who work in those corporations. Gradually to hand over the management of the corporations to the people who are working in the corporations.
Something like the Mussolini Italian system?
No. Something more like the Yugoslav system.
Mm-hmm. Is that practicable?
Surely. It's worked in Yugoslavia.
Mm-hmm.
With suitable modifications and with a gradual introduction, there is no reason why it should not.
But hasn't the whole social structure to change?
Yes.
First?
Yes, no, it has to change. I don't necessarily say first, why not at the same time?
Mm-hmm. In fact, for instance, the status levels, isn't that a hindrance to this kind of organization you're suggesting? The status concepts?
Yes, all that will have to go, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Engineers and management will have to sit together with workers. Those who are not ready to do that will have to go.
What about the question of managerial skill?
Yeah.
Do the workers have the managerial skill?
No.
So in that case, won't these combinations affect performance?
No, what about the existing managers? Nobody sent them away.
Yes, but presumably this compromise or combination arrangement would bring pressure to bear on the managers and
Sorry, that's what it's meant for.
Yes, but policy decisions might affect their performance. Policy decisions might bear on managerial skill.
Yeah. Yes, there might be a certain loss in efficiency, there might be a certain gain in efficiency. We are hoping that the gains will be much bigger than the losses.
I'm just trying to get a balance. I was just wondering whether the fact that it has worked in Yugoslavia does not necessarily mean that the conditions are suitable in Ceylon.
I didn't say they were.
Mm-hmm.
I said what is there in Yugoslavia with the necessary modifications.
Mm-hmm.
And with that element of gradualness which is also necessary.
Mm-hmm.
There's no reason why it should not succeed.
In fact, talking of gradualness, how effective or ineffective has the switch over to the Swabhasha been administered?
Well, it has not been as effective as it might have been, but it has been quite effective as a whole.
I was wondering if the Bandaranaike regimes tended to take too many ad hoc and rather vague decisions on this point.
Not only on this point, on every point. And not only the Bandaranaike regime, every regime that has existed so far has proceeded without planning.
Mm-hmm.
So it's more free to go with the plan.
In fact, wasn't Bandaranaike the man, as a man, tended to, rather prone to temporize and procrastinate?
Yes, possibly so.
I mean, now for instance, 58, it is said that he was provoked to declare emergency by a hint from the LSSP that unless he took action, they would use their youth leagues and other organizations to keep order.
Yes.
Is that correct?
No.
Mm-hmm. LSSP didn't...
Correct.
Well, I think I have...